Welcome to the Full 60 featuring Craig Custance and presented by The Athletic. Each week, we'll dive into the biggest stories in hockey while bringing in unique voices to entertain and explain all aspects of the game.
Hey, this is Craig, and welcome to this week's episode of The Full 60. And I am thrilled to be joined by Chicago Steel GM Ryan Hardy. And I don't typically give out credentials at the start of this, but I do want to, if you don't follow the USHL, which you should, I wanted to highlight a couple of things about Ryan, and he has to sit and listen to this. He was, in 2019, as a rookie GM in the USHL, was named the GM of the Year, and that's a very small group of people have earned that accomplishment. In that small group, I believe, and Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong, if you know this, John Cooper's in that group, right? Wasn't he one of the rookie GMs of the year?
I believe so.
Yeah, worked out okay. Like, John's doing okay for himself. The Chicago Steel have become almost the model franchise in terms of player development. And we're going to get into some of this, you know, kind of seen as this progressive franchise. I don't know if Ryan, I have no sense of whether or not he views it that way, but I know from the outside they're seen that way. As we sit here right now, they're in first place in the Eastern Conference in the USHL. Since Ryan has joined as GM, they have the most wins in the USHL. So I would say it's going pretty well. But mostly, I put together a list of 40 people under 40. And I got more comments about not having Ryan on that list. So let me start there, Ryan. I want to apologize. I guess I completely screwed that up because people seemed really upset you weren't on that list.
It's funny. interesting way to get this started, Craig. No, it's hey, it's one of those things. And I think I look forward to lists coming out every year. And for me, it's actually great because there's a lot of people that you highlight that sometimes I don't know, you know. Yeah. And I get to kind of study them and learn about them. And in my role, you know, always looking for the next up and coming person. And obviously Noel works with me now. So it's a good opportunity for her to rib me. So no harm, no foul. All good on my end.
All right. That's good to know. I hope I hadn't burned a source even before we got to know each other. So that was good to know, or a potential source. And it's funny because I think sometimes you outthink yourself when you're doing this, right? Like, I like to help with discovery. Part of the fun thing of doing those lists, and not to get into the weeds right off the hop here, is, hey, I'm gonna highlight some people that people might not know. And I was like, you know, obviously you were part of the, you know, list that I was putting together initially. And I'm like, well, everyone knows Ryan. Like, I feel like The Athletic has been a well documented it. And so I just didn't feel, but I think in doing so, people were like, hey, like, this guy, what he's accomplished in this short period of time is pretty remarkable. And Ryan, have you, like, has it sunk in just how well things have been going for you? Like, as it's taken off?
I would say yes and no. You know, I think that we're so busy and so just entrenched it in what we're doing every day and trying to, you know, like, say we try to run a progressive organization, like, we're trying to do things that no one else is doing. And then when you're doing that, you're trying to always find the next thing and the next thing. And so it becomes this great, it's a great thing to work through in that way. And it's so fun to be continuing to chase whatever is next or highlight, you know, what the next part of development that we want to add. But at the same time, you know, I am so blessed to have had all these different opportunities that I've had and to work alongside people that I, you know, consider friends and love going to work every day. And, you know, when I started, I didn't have any relationships in hockey. I don't come from a hockey family. I don't have any, you know, connections that I leverage. I started coaching little kids hockey, Bantam B hockey, when I was 18 years old. And so, yeah, sometimes I do pause and reflect and get a chuckle about where this has gone so far and where it's probably going in the future. And I'm just so grateful. And I love hockey and certainly take a lot of pride in what we've been able to accomplish.
I want to get into that. I'm always fascinated by people that have had to carve out a career in this space really with no, you know, you didn't get the boost of being a, you know, a 1,000-game NHL player, right? Like, you had to really carve it out. Almost, you know, we mentioned John Cooper at the outset. Like, there's – John's the same way. It's completely on merit, and I want to dive into that. But I wanted us to start first with this season in the USHL and what you guys are doing, and because there is a lot of attention being played, you know, being paid to, like, how prospects are being evaluated, how these games are going. Can you just – Tell the audience how you guys have handled playing and how it's gone so far at that level for you guys?
Yeah, it's been great insofar as, you know, the virus is a complicated thing, and there's obviously very passionate opinions on all sides of it and what the impact of that is. And I would say my heart breaks, you know, for the kids in the Ontario League, in the Western League, whether it be kids that are in their first year draft eligibility or 20-year-olds. You know, guys, that these are so important. This time is so important to them, and not getting to play. And for us, you know, it's been great in that way to get to play. You know, I'd be lying to you if I didn't say it's been by far the most stressful year I've ever had in hockey. You just carry so much. I naturally take a lot of pride in my care level for the players on my team, and in this kind of virus year, it's just that much heightened. You know, and our league has done a really good job of working through, you know, when the virus pops up, and having really good protocols in place to make sure that if a player does, you know, contract the virus, that there's a return to play process that, like for us, for example, we check their hearts before we in any physical activity. And we want to make sure that, you know, the cost is significant to test as much as we do, and to do that additional testing to make sure that they're healthy before they return to play. But I think that we have an obligation to do that. And, you know, for all of us, you know, we've spent a lot of time within our program over the years looking at mindset and resilience and the mental health component and how that impacts player development. And I think that this year that's heightened. And I hope that for all of us in this sport and in sport at large, we can come out of this with a much greater understanding of the mental burdens that these kids bear in a regular season. And be more mindful of that and be more mindful of the responsibility that comes, you know, as the caretakers of their dreams. So it's been crazy. Most of the teams, you know, have adjusted and settled in, and we've gotten most of our games played. And we have 19 games left, I think, in the regular season before playoffs, and everything, all things considered, has gone well, and we're just thrilled to be playing.
I know how much of a I don't want to say burden, but this hasn't been a great year financially for NHL teams, and these are, you know, this is the cream of the crop, and these are billionaire owners. How has the USHL and your franchise handled that, the financial strains of this, right? Like, it's got to be multiplied at that level.
Yeah, it's significant. Fortunately for us, we too have a billionaire.
Yeah, you do too. Right? So
that certainly does help that, you know, for us as staff, he reached out to us early in the summer and was like, hey, no one's getting furloughed. We'll take care of everybody. You know, we're going to do it this way. And, you know, if Illinois doesn't allow us to play, and Larry Robbins is our owner's name, he said, hey, we'll look in another state and I'll run the team out of another state and whatever we got to do so that the kids can have these developmental opportunities all through. So we've been blessed to have an owner with that type of commitment and that type of willingness. You know, we're one of the teams in the Midwestern United States. It's an interesting place where there's a very different views on many items. And we're one of the states that doesn't allow fans. We just got to 50 the other day. So, you know, we've been playing in an empty arena, and to our owner's credit, he just hasn't cut anything. He's let us kind of operate business as usual and do the best that we can for the kids. And that part's been good.
The payoff, we've all talked a lot about the risks, and even down to the kind of the long-term health, and you mentioned the heart, and I think there's a lot we don't know about that kind of the health aspect, but in terms of the development and the payoff, you know, you mentioned some of these other leagues that aren't going, like where have you seen the growth in your young players that have gotten the opportunity to play?
I think for us, we typically specialize in young players and we operated under this idea that winning, which we all love to do, is a byproduct of investing in the development of our players. So it's really been business as usual for us. And like I said, we've always been mindful of the mental component for these kids that move far away from home and are chasing a dream. And we're kind of the ones that are bearing the responsibility of allowing them to, further dreams to foster. So, we've always been mindful of that piece. So I would say for us, for me, I think the stress has increased insofar as you always are worried about, the 25 kids when you put your head on the pillow at night. And that's probably a little more this year, just where they're not able to hang out. They're not able to do the things that they normally get to do. And you think about some of these kids that billet and don't have a teammate that billets with them. And it's very isolating. And it's just about, trying to find as much normalcy as they can. But we have them at the rink more or less 9 to 5 every day. So things for us have operated as close to normal as they possibly could. And once we got playing games around American Thanksgiving, it's pretty much been as normal as it could be. And like I said, we're just doing the best that we can, but it hasn't, we actually haven't been too impacted and development is always what we're focused on. So, it's been pretty good, all things considered.
Even during the best of times, I was reading where you guys have either a company or somebody that you're working with that develops, the phrase that I read was mindset resilience development, which I'm not sure mindset, and you can correct me if I'm getting it wrong. I'm not sure if I've ever heard of mindset resilience. What is that, and what does that look like for you guys?
So as you know, since you've spent a lot of time talking to these guys, we have Adam and Daryl, Belfry and Adam Nicholas in player development, which is more of an on-ice focus. And then we were looking at development of these young players. And I really thought about my own life. And at what point did I get to a level where I actually felt truly self-confident? And I was probably I'd say maybe 28, 29 years old. Mm-hmm. I think about these kids that are like an Adam Fantilli comes down here, now an Owen Power, is going through the scrutiny that he's going through and the pressure that these kids carry. For Adam, when he came, he was 15. When Owen came, he was 15 and now going through the draft. And then you think about even, players that play in the NHL, 18, 19 years old, hit their bonuses, they become millionaires and all of these things. And I was like, wow, the pressure that they have to feel beyond just this pursuit of their dreams and just this situation where it is so competitive. Like there's just a lot going on. And I felt that the resilience piece and the mindset was the area of development that was probably the next frontier that I wanted to dive into. So we partnered with this company. It's called Maltium. It's actually out of Toronto.
Okay.
Body Fusion. It's two brothers, Matt and Chris Calderoni. And what they, in a typical year, they would come in about 1 week a month or once every 6 weeks and spend a week with us and do more on-site stuff. And then our players, which now we're just doing those through Zoom, and our players have access to them at all times. So sometimes we'll have players that, and then they just give them tools and systems and processes to work through different situations and hold themselves to a certain standard. And when they're, the genesis of it was when we would have these young players, particularly first year players, once their confidence went in that rookie season, they never got it back, And so it was like, what can we do to let them, we're always saying, hey, this is part of the process. This is part of development. And adversity is a gift and all these things. But now can we put some more kind of, organized processes in place to give them that support? And it's an outside person that isn't the coach. And I, I pride myself a lot on the interpersonal relationships that I have with the kids. I think that they know that they can come and talk to me and deal with me on any issue of life. And there's some things that, whether it's more performance-based or there's some things they might not even want to talk to me about. So we have this company and they don't, without, the player's permission, they don't really tell us, what the situation is. Those guys work through it. Just another resource for our kids to help them develop and become the best that they can be.
And maybe you don't have an answer to this because you're not sitting in, it is kind of between the player and the company, but do you have an example of what that organized process would look like in terms of kind of developing a mindset?
Yeah. So, I'll give you one example. We just had a conversation the other day, and we have a young player, extremely intelligent, very skilled, and he's very, very nice. Just a really nice kid. And sometimes that shows itself in the game as a little soft. And right. So, you know, I would talk with the mindset guys, and I'd say, hey, they talk about something they reference like an alter ego. So basically having this persona that you like stay being a nice, awesome, you know, great human being. But then when you go on the ice, kind of become a different person and add these layers. And then they, you know, have different, you know, whether it's through continued dialogue, through things that they give the kids to read, through kind of these app-based, you know, programming, this app-based programming that they've built out, and then just constant dialogue. So like we'll have some kids that, like I'll give an example, sometimes call a spade in hockey, sometimes the parents are tough on the kids. Mm-hmm. So sometimes after, you know, we'll have players over the years that have called them, like they'll call Matt Calderoni right after the game before they talk to mom and dad, and they'll talk through the situation, and they'll kind of get on a level, you know, playing field or what have you for to prepare for that next call. And then it's, you know, hey, these are kind of the things we want to talk through. And it's just about, you know, trying to, in a holistic way, set the kids up for the most success and be able to deal with some of the outside external factors that they have to navigate.
It's funny. You mentioned the alter ego, and it just popped in my head. Like I would watch a guy like Shane Doan play a hockey game, and, you know, he, you know, played on the edge. And then if you met Shane Doan, was the nicest human being you could ever meet in person and talk to. And, you know, that does exist. And I always wondered that, like, how do you balance it? Like, this is just a complete aside. I was thinking as you were saying it, but Shane, it was like two different people completely.
Oh, it's funny that you reference him. Shane's boy, Josh, plays for us. And
oh, really? I didn't even realize that. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. And I would say as an adult, you know, Shane Doan is kind of like my idol, just in the way of he's such a remarkable person, you know, and you're always trying to strive to get better as a person. And you look at this man and all that he accomplished and just the way that he treats everybody and the way that he goes about his business. And then if you, you know, do a Twitter search on him or when he comes up or something pops up, you know, some of the opposing fans talk about him like he's some kind of monster.
Oh, my gosh.
He wants to run everybody from behind. He's a terrible guy. And I see it too, like with Brady Tkachuk, who's one of the greatest young people, you know, I've ever been around, and he's such a sweet kid, and he plays a different way, you know, and it is funny, and it you know, it speaks to you know, I think a lot of people have a public, you know, perception of what they are and then what they actually are, and oftentimes it's different. But yeah, I think for Shane, he was telling me stories about his father, who's like, the way he was describing him was just like the toughest man I'd ever heard of. One time he ran himself over with an ATV and split his face wide open and drove 20 miles home. Like it was just insane. I think that kind of, yeah, that kind of is the DNA that he has and where he comes from. And he's tough and he plays on the edge and he plays hard. And, but as a man, he's as kind as they get.
It's funny when you mentioned like you're dealing with these kids when they're 15 or 16 or whatever. And like, I, you know, that was a reminder that it's a different group than what I'm normally talking to somebody about. And I'm just curious how much of your, you finding it a need to work on the mental side and getting through the disappointment and the ups and downs that come with that age comes from being part of, you know, those groups at the program. Like I think of that U17 group coming in and getting like their clocks cleaned by like older players. I don't know, like some kids, I have to imagine their confidence just gets shot that first year in the program. Do you think that influence, like seeing kids kind of have to battle through that, how much do you think that influences your, how much you feel like this needs to be developed in this age group?
Yeah, I would say a lot of these ideas I've come up with were born out of that experience in the program. Yeah. And I think there's two sides of it. You know, there's the one of the kid who most of the kids have never faced adversity in their hockey career.
Right. Like,
certainly many have faced adversity in their life, but most of them have not faced too much adversity in their hockey career. And most of them, their physical gifts are so good that they've never even had to think their way around the rink. And they've certainly never had to defend. So you add all these things and now you're playing and now you're being challenged. And now where you've always been either the best or the second best player on your team, Now you might be the 20th best player on the team, and you're working through that. And some guys come in as men and some come in as boys. And so there's that side of it where you recognize the need for mindset development. And then the opposite side of it is the kids that come in and their talent is so great that even the program doesn't challenge them enough. So they come in right from the beginning and they have 2 points, you know, a game in the USHL as a 16-year-old, and then they're dominant, and then off they go and they get picked, you know, 15th overall, and life is good and everything's going to be great. And then life smacks them in the face in the American Hockey League. You know, they don't make the NHL right away, and now they're in the American Hockey League and they don't have any skills to deal with this. And the American Hockey League is a place where it's not designed really to worry about your feelings. You're a professional athlete and you're in there competing. And when you're ready to play in the NHL, you will play. And if you're not ready, it'll eat you up. So I thought a lot about those players of, okay, instead of just giving them a free pass because their talent dictates that this level is too easy for them, what challenges can we put in place and how can we develop their mindset? And you look at Owen Power, who we had for 2 years before he went to Michigan. He was extraordinary in the way of Trish and Z Power. His parents are about as perfect of hockey parents as you could ever have. So he's just a very wholesome, it just is all there for him. Now we would do things to him we would always go in the second year. We would always ask questions about what can we do to make this harder on him? Because mm-hmm. he's good, you know? So it was trying to manufacture adversity for him. And then, you know, the different players that we've had trying to create adversity for them in a controlled environment without breaking their confidence, and then giving them the tools to work through adversity when it comes. That's a huge part of the mindset stuff we're doing. So yeah, it is for the kid that is losing his confidence. And it's also for the kid that probably has too much, what I would call fake confidence, because they've never really had to work through a challenge. It's just come easy to them because they're so, you know, gifted. And for those players, oftentimes the mindset development is more valuable even than the other guy.
It's interesting. So you mentioned Owen Power, you mentioned some of these players that you've gotten to come to your program, and you're competing against the best of the best in Canada. How much do you think this, your kind of well-rounded approach, and we haven't even gotten into the Belfry, all the other stuff you guys are doing, how much do you think that has allowed you guys to bring in, these high-end guys that maybe would have been going to London or wherever normally?
Yeah, I think it's huge. I think, definitely the experience I had the program, and then, going to the Bruins and spending a couple of years there and kind of getting to see this at every level and going back certainly gave me a little bit of credibility. Yeah. And then when I came back to this level to run a junior hockey team, it was never about winning the USHL. It was, like you say, the London Knights, the Portland Winterhawks, U.S. program, Frölunda, Halifax Moosehead, St. John, all these teams that have done a remarkable job and have built these brands. I was like, hey, we have this little league, the USHL, which I think is a great league and probably a league that is gaining more and more respect, but probably could command even more respect than it does get. And I was like, hey, I think that we can do things that are unique and that are different and create an environment where kids from all around the world will recognize that, hey, this might be the best thing that exists in junior hockey and in hockey development anywhere in the world. And, we've been fortunate with all the resources that we have and the people that we have that we've been able to build this thing. But certainly, yeah, I think that was our objective and that was our goal. And it's certainly what we set out to do.
So, it's probably a year ago now, roughly, is when Adam Fantilli committed to the program to you guys. I got to say program to the Chicago Steel. Can you just take us through what that process looks like from your perspective and selling it and how that played out?
Yeah. So Adam, he had played up in the GTHL when he's in 04. He had played with the 03s. So I had watched him the year before, and certainly you look at a physical package like that, and you're excited, especially with the late birthday on it. And so we probably had been following him for a year. And then his brother, Luca, also plays for us. He's a really smart two-way defenseman. So we had drafted his brother.
Yeah.
And the only thing I had said to his parents, and no different than the first time I sat down with Brady Tkachuk, it's, hey, your brother, his process is this and your process is this, and they're not the same. And we've had a lot of brothers. We had the Robbins brothers. We have had Slavin brothers. We had Down brothers. So we just happened to have a lot of brothers come through. And I always try to, make sure that guys are having a different, having their own independent process. So, but with Adam, we had identified him and evaluated him. And certainly I think the success that Owen had really built a bridge to Canada. And I think kids in the greater Toronto area were able to look at Owen Power and say, oh man, like, wait a second, this guy went a different path. And now, he's probably more likely not going to be the number one pick. And so the success that he had, I think, opened a door and that, we're through that process. And then obviously, with Brisson and Colangelo and Farrell and all these guys, I think we had 8 or 9 draft picks last year that came through. And so the momentum started to build. And, Adam, kind of the recruiting process with him is pretty simple. It was virtual. He was supposed to come down on a visit, and then the borders were about to get closed. So he went back to Canada, and we did it on Zoom and just talked about what our program is and what we offer. And, our thing with Adam, just like it is for any high-end player, is that we're not here to tell you, like, we don't believe in a 15-year-old phenom. You're not a superstar. You're just a kid. And you have these certain talents that are elite, and then you have these other areas that are opportunities for you to grow, to be the very best that you can be. And for me, if Adam Fantilli, comes through this program and eventually gets, is a high pick and plays a long time in the NHL, but we just give him a free pass to do whatever he wants by virtue of his talent, then we would have failed him. And so we're here and we're challenging him and we're pushing him and trying to put him in uncomfortable spots. And he's thriving. He's doing a great job. He's adding layers to his game all the time. And he's been a treat to have. But yeah, our process is not, hey, here's all these shiny things and you're going to come here and you're going to be the man. We don't look at it that way. We just look at it of, hey, we have this kind of development machine we've created. We think it's the best. And you have a lot of talent, and come here and we're going to treat you just like we would any other kid. And we're going to invest in your development as a player and as a person. And we're going to try to get you to have the tools to achieve all your dreams. And that's pretty much what we promise. And for some guys that like the shiny things or want to be told, hey, you're going to play first line and you're going to play first power play from the get go, it doesn't fit in our program. Credit to Adam, he's bought into the process and he's getting better every day. And, he'll have options, whether it's eventually to go play in the OHL or to go to college. Certainly those options are on the horizon for him. And he'll make those decisions when he's ready to make them.
Can you start sending some of those kids to Michigan State though? I feel like we need the pipeline.
Yeah, we obviously have had a lot of Wolverines lately.
Yeah, I don't love that.
Our captain, Eric Middendorf, actually, and he's third in the league in scoring now. He just committed to Michigan State around Christmas. So we're starting to send DC some guys. I'll work on that for you.
I appreciate that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right. So we haven't even gotten into the on-ice stuff. And that can even reflect, your work with Daryl and Adam Nicholas and some of that. But I also want to get into just philosophy, right? Like, I think the way you put it at one point in an interview, it was kind of trying to marry some of those old school habits that you know work in hockey versus kind of a progressive mindset of a modern game. What does that look like in practicality?
Yeah, so I was born in 1985.
Okay,
so I'd say the height of hockey as I remember it is like mid to late 90s Red Wings Avalanche.
Okay.
and it was brutal and physical. But each side had all these Hall of Famers, and like so many of the best players in the NHL played for the Red Wings or played for the Avalanche. And think about, you know, Joe Sakic and Peter Forsberg and all these guys and Steve Yzerman and Fedorov and just the different way that the Russians played and the different way that Forsberg played and then the Canadian players and kind of how it all blended. And so I have a great affinity for even a guy that like lays down and takes a shot off his face. Like I have a great appreciation for that. And there are, you know, kind of old school habits and details that are part of the fabric of this game. And then I watch Russian players, you know, going back, we did a great Zoom this summer, with Anatoly Tarasov's grandson, which was really cool. And Lou Barrow. Really? Yeah, it was awesome. And we probably went for 4 or 5 hours talking about different theories and different things that they had done in Russians. Then I looked at the Finns and I looked at the Swedes and I just thought about, you know, hockey. I went a couple of years ago. I flew to San Francisco and drove cross country with no plan and just went place to place and just stopped. And I went to Cirque du Soleil at the Bellagio and I just watched this like incredible choreographed, like beautiful production. And then I kind of think of hockey in that way of like a beautiful experience where all this talent is on display and there's an artistic component to it. And then there's also kind of a brutal component to it. And I think that, you know, that's just kind of how I look at the game, that there's sometimes where the game calls for you to do these things that are fit, whether it's grit or, like just getting run over to make a play or bring physicality or fight, like those are part of hockey. But at the same time, I find like dump the puck, forecheck, get the puck, go low to high, D to D, throw it on net, tip pucks, recover, shoot. I find that very boring. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's an expression of the players, you know, artistic creativity. And so that's what we try to do is we try to, one, unlock their creativity and allow them to be creative. And then, you know, with the great coaches that we have, Brock Sheehan, Mike Garman, Matt Duchamp, and Greg Moore before them, and then with Adam and Daryl, they're all collaborating to add these layers to each player's game and add these layers to the way that we play. And so, we try to play a unique style, but also at the end of the day, you know, those tried and true components of hockey are always going to be part of hockey, you know, and the pendulum could swing too far to this quote unquote aggressive style. And so we just try to find enough of the foundation that's built in, you know, what most people view hockey to be, and then, you know, allow that to show itself in this more artistic way that we see it. And I think it's a fun way for players to play. And certainly for fans, it's an exciting, you know, brand of hockey to watch.
Is there anything you guys are doing structurally or kind of philosophically that other teams aren't doing? Like, I don't know, from the way you're identifying positions or just the way you're playing, is there something?
Yes and no. I think that there's some, you know, things in our forecheck or in our D zone or in our power play that are slightly different, but more so just in allowing more freedom for the players.
Yeah.
So it's just less rigid, I would say. And okay, there's a lot of talk about like positionless hockey and do we play positionless hockey? Like I don't think that we do play positionless hockey, but I think that we have no problem if a D-man is leading the line rush. We have no problem if a D-man is in the corner in the offensive zone, as long as we have balance and we have, you know, the support where it needs to be and we have a plan. You can go anywhere you want to go. And we recruit and draft players that can handle the puck and that can make plays and that are creative, and that's at every position. So and then we work through those, you know, offensive zone concepts to utilize our D-man and play in a very interchangeable way. But there's certain things I think that like a forward who's had a lifetime of reps scoring goals, you know, in a certain area of the rink, it's very hard to just instill that into a 17-year-old defenseman.
Sure.
Where the defenseman, you know, feeling the line rush and boxing out in front of the net, you can, you know, add those layers to forwards But they'll never be, you know, quite as good as the defenseman that's already had, you know, a lifetime of experience playing them. So it's trying to blend those concepts and instill them in everybody and allow us to play in a very interchangeable way. But I don't know that a five-man interchangeable positionless hockey, I don't know what that looks like or if we ever do get there. And we have had a couple games. We had so many injuries. We played about 6 weeks where we were decimated with forwards, and we played two defensemen on the wings. So we would have four defensemen on the ice and a center. And it was interesting. There were some things we picked up from it that maybe we'll go back and experiment later. There are some things that we do that are different, but more so it's allowing more freedom to the players. But we still have structure. We still have a plan. We still have routes. Like everybody else, we just maybe do it slightly different and allow for more freedom and allow for more mistakes to be made in that development process.
What are some of the old school details that you think are non-negotiable that still need to be a part of the game?
I think like work ethic, competitiveness off the puck. Like I have a lot of conversations about defense. I think this idea of blocking shots and doing these kind of tougher, whatever, things that are associated with defense. You know, I think there's other ways to do that. Like I kind of cringe if one of our best players was blocking a shot in the first period of game 27, you know, but I think working off the puck, working for your teammates, being accountable to other players, using your skill and creativity inside the framework of a team game and not just using your skill and creativity to go on an island to put on a show. I think all of those things are important and are, and there are just some times in the game where you have to punt, you have to flip a puck out, you have to dump a puck in a one-on-three, you have to, you know, make sure you're disciplined in your changes and all those things. And I think that, you know, those are the fabric of what hockey is. And certainly for us, I think when we get too loose and try to play this weekend, we won 8-7 and lost 7-6. And that's not really how we want to play. We want to win 8-1. So you know, I think having those off the puck habits are probably the ones that we're most after in terms of a traditional way to play.
One of the things your owner highlighted about you, and I think it was when you won the GM of the year, was that you have an ability to identify and mentor coaches that he appreciates. And you've already, you know, you mentioned Greg Moore, and he's now with the Marlies, and you've graduated a coach there. What are you looking for? Because they have to align philosophically, right? Like, doesn't do this deal any good for you to have one mentality and then your coach, then you bring in somebody who wants your star to block shots. Like, when you're looking for coaches that fit your kind of mindset, what are you looking for?
I think that probably one of the most important things to us is that everyone has to be aligned. Mm-hmm. I've always found it somewhat odd that maybe a manager will see hockey a certain way and a team will have a coach that is aligned with the manager, but then they're not having success. And then he fires that coach and then goes to a polar opposite coach. And if the coach and the general manager are not aligned in how the team should play, what the type of players that the team needs and should be drafting and the way that the scout should be looking at things, I don't see how it ever works. And then you just end up with this hodgepodge of random players style that maybe they're not designed to play. And they're trying to be, you're trying to put, you know, a round peg in a square hole or whatever that example is. And so for me, I look at it of one, I think that the head coach in hockey probably bears too much responsibility. Like there's no way that one person can, you know, oversee all these pre-scouts, oversee all the X's and O's, oversee the development piece. And a lot of coaches, you know, and Daryl is probably more critical about this than me. Like a lot of coaches don't really have a great understanding of what development is or beyond, you know, the habits and details that we talk about that are, you know, kind of tried and true. Beyond that, you know, a lot of coaches aren't thinking about how can I add layers to this player's offensive game? How can I expand his brain? How can I, you know, make him better and have more tools at his disposal? They're more trying to work towards reliability. So for me, I have to look for coaches that, one, want to collaborate with our development team, because that's a huge part of what we're doing. Two, want to understand that we're going to have the youngest team in the league every year, and having young players is challenging and it's difficult. And also, like, we always change our lineup all the time until, like, I don't know, six games left in the regular season. And because we want kids to play with different players, we want them to play different positions, play left wing, play center, you know, play right wing, play with this guy, play with that guy, and learn, just because when they go beyond here, they're going to play with whoever the coach puts them with. So, you know, we need a coach that is open to doing those types of things and wants to collaborate with a lot of different people. And our coach is able to give input in scouting, and our scouting, you know, if our equipment manager, you know, has something that he picks up in the game and he wants to share it with the coach. Like, one thing that we're looking for is, anyone, if you got a good idea, like, bring your idea to the table and let's, you know, flesh it out and let's work through it. So just having a coach with that kind of mindset. And I think with that, I think anyone that's successful in this business has some ego. But, you know, being willing to put aside your own self-interest, and for everyone that works for us, we're always asking them that, we, you know, our owner, he's the one that signs the checks, but we work for the players. This is a player's game. So everyone, whether you're the general manager, assistant general manager, head scout, the head coach, the associate coach, you're all accountable to the players. Our job is to make them the best that they can be so that they can perform. So I think that, where, like, I'll never have a coach that, you know, thinks it's about him, or, you know, the coaches aren't here to serve or the players aren't here to serve the coach. You know, we're all here to give the players the best tools that we can and support them and make them the best that they can be so that our team can be the best that we can be. And I would say those are the qualities that I most look for in a coach. And then just a guy who, you know, wants to collaborate, is a good leader. All of our coaches are good men and good role models for the young people, and they work hard and they care about the organization, and really that's just what we're after.
You seem to have very clear vision for what you want, but we kind of alluded to it earlier, how you had to work your way kind of organically up the food chain here, or you are working your way up. What was that first step? Like, what was your first really kind of foot in the door into this world?
Yeah, I started, coaching little kids hockey, never set out to do this as a job. And then kind of one thing led to another. And I guess my first real coaching opportunity was at Williams College, which is a small Division III school in the northwest corner of Massachusetts. And so I started there the year after I graduated from college. I probably, you know, thought that I would be a coach, that would be my way. And then eventually I segued into the scouting field and got experience in that way. And throughout that whole process, I had this incredible, you know, passion for player development. So just kind of looking at all these things. And then, eventually this management situation is where I fell into. Never really set out to do that. But it's where I stumbled into. And I think one of the things for me, I love the human part of coaching, but I don't like video. I don't like all this, you know, the mundane that kind of drives me nuts. Right. So I'm not really that good as a coach, but in my role, I get to do kind of the parts of coaching that I do love. I still get to do them. And the ones that I don't like, I don't have to do. And then I just, you know, kind of augment that with the scouting. And that's probably the area that, maybe I have most aptitude in. And, So it worked out pretty good for me, in kind of a bizarre winding road that I never really planned on going down.
What do you do to get better? Like, you have a clear plan for your players, for your own personal development. Where does that focus stand?
Yeah, I try to draw inspiration from anything, mm-hmm. Whether anywhere I can get it. A lot of times, and I'll pull things oftentimes from non-traditional things, like maybe watching a movie, you know, and just picking up something that has nothing to do with hockey. And probably the best time that I have is it's difficult in this profession, I think, to find time to yourself. And I find the most The best time is just when I get in my car and drive.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll just get in my car and just drive for 2 hours and think and listen to music and just have, try to clear my mind and just allow ideas to come to me. And then I'm always searching, whether it's, you know, passages in a book or quotes, like quotes. I'm not a big, like, put quotes on the wall guy, but I like quotes when they kind of get your brain thinking about something. And so I guess that's it. More than anything, just finding any medium to stimulate my brain and try to find more original thought as opposed to recycling ideas that might not, you know, really fit into what it is that we're trying to do because we've quite frankly already gone past.
Right. Do you have a something in your daily regimen that really allows you to kind of to tap into that space?
Yeah. So I used to, when you, as you climb through the ranks and you start reading, like whether it's a book or whatever it is about how to, you know, like things of successful people. And then you see all these things of work, life balance and routine. And so I was like, okay, yeah, I'm after those. And then I learned very quickly that I was never like, I'm in love with hockey. It's what I love to do. And I was never going to achieve a work-life balance. So I would find myself, you know, in these situations that were not work-related and my mind was always on work or I was always looking for something, you know, that had to do with hockey. And so what I came up with was I basically have just, I never set an alarm. I don't really schedule anything throughout the day. And if I want to go to the driving range at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday, I'll just go to the driving range at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday. And if I want to get in my car and drive, I'll get in my car and drive. And so I've just created this thing where, you know, every week there's 6 or 7 things that I have to do. And then around those, you know, it doesn't really matter if I'm sending emails at 3 o'clock in the morning or if I'm, you know, going out to, well, you know, lunch at 11 with different people. I just have given myself the freedom to operate really without any constraint. And in doing that, like if I'm after a situation where I want to, you know, allow for my brain to come up with different ideas or I just carve out that time and go and do it. So it's a little not traditional. I really wouldn't recommend that people follow but it works for me.
I was already thinking I couldn't do 2 days of what you just described. I'm like, I put stuff into my calendar and structure it or else I get like anxiety. It's funny. Like, yeah, I was getting stressed listening to you.
It's definitely different. Yeah.
All right. One more before we go to break. The book that has impacted you the most. I do like asking people this question. It seems like you might have a good answer. I don't know though.
The book that has impacted me the most. I read a book last year, Sapiens.
Mm. That's on the list. It's supposed to be just great.
Incredible read about, you know, humankind and just the history and evolution of the world. And it just looked at things in such a different way. And I would say I try to find parallels and things outside of sport and draw them back in. So that was an incredible, because I feel like so much of what we're doing is just dealing with humans, you know, and understanding kind of the evolution. And so that was that. And then more sport specific. Pretty much anything. I'm a big Belichick guy. Mm-hmm. So any Belichick book, I've read them all. I have some in hardcover and also audiobook. So I have a good library of those. USA Hockey put out a great book on Tarasov, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 years ago. That's probably the best hockey book that I've read.
They did that? I didn't know that. So I've been kicking around. Like, I feel like there's an opportunity for someone to buy like the U.S. rights to some of his books and translate it and publish it. I feel like that's so something someone should do.
We had on the Zoom that we did.
Yeah.
One of the gentlemen that was on it, he's in Iowa and he has all of his books in Russian and he's working on translating them with Tarasov's grandson. So he has that, but yeah, U.S. put out a great one. It's big and it's to be a tough read. It reads kind of like a medical textbook.
Yeah,
but certainly, you know.
Do you know what it's called? If people want to look it up or find it,
I don't.
All right, I'll try to find out.
Tarasov, something about a mastermind or something like that. But it's put out by USA Hockey. It's not cheap. I think like you can get them on eBay for like $300 or $400.
Yeah, they're hard to find.
Yeah, they are.
Like, this is a whole area that, like a rabbit hole I haven't gone down, but I'm dying to do. All right, so let's go right into, I opened it up on Twitter, so I'll, which I noticed I was going to tag you. I don't see you on Twitter anymore. I don't know if you want to explain that.
Yeah, but, yeah, I retired from Twitter.
I'd love to retire from Twitter. So, all right, so this one, this is a natural question. This comes from Billy Terrell, who asks, what's your long-term plan and goal, and when will you be transitioning to the NHL?
Yeah, that's probably the question I get asked the most. I think for me, like, I've had some different opportunity come up over the last couple of years. I learned through this process that you want to be places where you're valued and where you're feeling like everyone is aligned and that you're working towards something, you know, exciting and purposeful. And so for me, you know, different things come up and I kind of look at them, you know, each in and of themselves. And for me, it's just going to be when the right fit comes, you know, the right organization with people that are aligned with me and in a role that, that I'm excited to do. And I find challenging and I feel like I can make an impact and, you know, I'm not in a hurry, certainly, to get out of here. I love my job, and I feel like we're doing something really unique, but opportunities do come up, and I haven't found the right one yet. But certainly, you know, when I do, I'll look at it long and hard and go at it with the same passion, you know, that I do the job I have.
I like this question from the same person. How do you weed through all the noise when you're recruiting somebody at a young age? And I imagine there's noise from – I don't know. There's coaches and parents and youth, like that whole space. I'm glad I don't have to operate inside of there. Like, how do you kind of cut through all that?
I think it's not too dissimilar than what we were talking about before of the experience I got as a national program, where mm-hmm. one of the most fascinating things I learned was like the power of the hype on some of these kids and why some make it and some don't. And you look at the hype and you look at the people surrounding them and the support system. And then you kind of study that and really reverse engineer it and sort through it. So for me, it's actually pretty easy because I've already been through that process there. And now I know, like, we have a very specific criteria of what we're looking for. Like, in our young player draft, which is for 16-year-olds, we have 10 picks. It's 160 picks in the draft, and we'll have 22 names. So our criteria is so small. That it like kind of this golf idea of aim small, miss small. So we have a very defined criteria, and oftentimes our criteria is different than what other people are doing. And I was working for the national team. I had to spend, you know, a big part of that job is recruiting. So you spend a lot of time with the families and you have to sell the program, whereas we have a draft. So I have to, I don't have to spend as much time with people so you don't get as caught up in the hype. And then, you know, with a lot of coaches of these teams, they usually work for another team in the USHL. So it's not like I'm picking their brain too much on the players either. So I pretty much just ignore the hype. And I think we're pretty convicted in what we're doing and think that we have a purposeful process that we're working through in scouting, where what the outside perception of a player is really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
We're just going to pick who we want to pick. And, you know, I think early on we did, we'll take a player in the second round and people would be like, well, that's crazy taking that guy in the seventh round. But eventually, you know, I've always felt like in drafts that I'd rather love the player and go earlier than miss out on him and just take a player that I like because he's on the board. So, you know, if you love a guy, we'll go up and get him. And that's just kind of how we look at it.
All right. This question comes from Topher Scott, who I think you know. He says, I should be sure to ask you about the 97 national team, NTDP team, specifically about how a few kids were slotted versus where they are now, like the Matthews, Tkachuks, and McAvoys, and how they developed with Donnie Granato. What is he alluding to there?
Yeah. Donnie, I love Don Granato. He taught me so much about hockey, and that was an awesome experience to get to work with him there. So when I got to the national program, I didn't recruit these kids, but the 96s and 97s were there. So I just kind of studied it and looked at them and watched it. And I remember in the under 17 year, Austin got hurt So he had broken his leg, I think. He missed most of the season. And Matthew Tkachuk and Jack Roslovic were the fourth line left wing and right wing. Eventually, by the time they went to U18 Worlds, those guys were Matthew's wingers, you know, 2 years later. And, I think that the fascinating thing, especially for parents, is that they go in and everyone is so consumed with the here and now. And so you look at the leading scorers or the guys that got more ice time in the U17 year, and then the evolution of that from the U17 year to the U18 year. And then now 5 years later, how it's just such a different grouping. And even like on the back end, I remember talking to Charlie McAvoy and he was saying that, when we came in, Hannafin and Werenski were kind of the top two guys. And Charlie said that he was one of the last guys added to the tryout camp and he barely made the team, you know, and so if Charlie starts as the eighth defenseman and now, you know, he'd certainly be in the class of Noah and Zach. And, I think it's just a great example for people to watch where they get so consumed by, okay, you make the NTDP or you're playing at the certain level at 17 and whatever success you have is just going to continue. Like, no, there's a lot of ebbs and flows, even at that high end of a level. And then getting to study, you know, the different families and the mindsets of the kids, like we talked about in the open. And it actually paints a pretty good picture of why some were successful and some weren't. And then also looking at their bodies, you know, some are grown men and some are underdeveloped boys. And if you're an underdeveloped boy and you can hang with those guys, eventually you're going to become a man and you'll probably pass them. And when you're a player, you have to find ways to think your way around a situation because you can't, you know, bully it through physicality. So, you know, kind of looking at that group, which was an amazing birth year, and watching the way they played and how guys have gone, it was just a fascinating, exercise. And I went to Topher. He ran a coaches conference a couple years ago and talked about that. And, we had a great discussion about it.
That's great. I've got a 15-year-old who's really into baseball, and he really draws inspiration when he finds, you know, late bloomers or whatever, right? Like, I think sometimes these kids think they're what they are at this moment is what they're going to be. And I mean, that's certainly not the case when you're 15 years old. But it's hard to realize that.
Right? When you're looking at your peers and they might be so far ahead of you, especially if you're, you know, a later birthday or a very physically underdeveloped kid, and you're like, how am I ever going to catch them? But when you get a 10,000, you know, foot view of it from above, it actually, you know, provides a great deal of clarity. And sometimes when you're talking to a 15-year-old, that's a difficult thing to convey.
Right. All right. Last one, because I know we're up against it here. This comes from a text from an NHL scout who was wondering, what have you learned as GM of the Steel that you wish you knew when you were a scout for the Bruins?
Great question. I probably would say that the Bruins were great to me. Like Scott Bradley, he really took me under his wing and I had a great time there. The biggest thing I learned is that life is very different when you're a decision maker versus suggestion maker. As a scout, I probably was too eager to be extremely passionate about my opinions and not understand maybe the larger view or not really have a full comprehension of what the manager, all the things that he was balancing. In terms of identifying the players, I think it's more been validating in the way of I have these theories. And then coming here and putting those theories to the test and working through it. Like, I think one of the great misnomers we spend so much time evaluating drafts and what is a successful draft or what is a great pick. And to me, drafting and development are not mutually exclusive. They're one and the same. And if you could select the best player, but if the development process that you create for that player is terrible, you might break them. And you can, you know, draft a player that maybe is in that second or third tier. But if he has the right mindset and your development processes are in place, you can make a player out of that guy. And so I would say that has more been validated through this process, but certainly those are my main takeaways from this experience. That probably, give me more clarity than I had when I was working for the Bruins.
Do you, and I know I already said last question, and this is, I like, sorry to push it, but you, do you have an example of something that you were really convicted of that you learned fairly quickly once you were in charge that it was a kind of an unreasonable opinion, or, you know what I mean? That it took the experience for you to figure out, okay, maybe I was wrong as a younger up and coming scout.
No, I really,
it's all proven out to be correct.
I hate to be that guy, but no, I think it's, this has gone pretty good. This is
all right. Good. Okay.
Better than I expected. So no, I would say more validating than there's something that I said, oh man, I really had that wrong.
That's awesome. Well, Ryan, thanks for doing this. This was an awesome conversation and I really appreciate it.
Thanks guys.
I want to thank Ryan Hardy for joining the podcast. It was a great conversation with Ryan, a guy that I've been meaning to catch up with. Cross paths occasionally. I'm trying to think the last, maybe at a draft or something, but he's one of those guys that, you know, super bright future in the world of hockey. Really, you can tell he's innovative, he's smart, progressive. He's gonna end up probably working for the Maple Leafs or somebody really soon at some point. And it's really cool to see what he's building in the USHL with the Chicago Steel. So thanks, Ryan. I appreciate you joining the podcast. It was a fun conversation. A couple things before we go. Steve Levy joins ESPN's. Oh, I've already said no longer ESPN's Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun. They are now ours. Steve Levy of ESPN joined Scott and Pierre on Two Man Advantage. And of course, ESPN is in the news because they're getting the hockey deal back. Great news for the world of hockey in the United States. And Levy is one of the best. I don't know what the plans are for Levy in hockey. I just hope he is at a lot of games because he's fun to hang out with, does a great job calling games. You should listen to that podcast. Also, if you're not a subscriber, as always, I would love for you to go to theathletic.com/full60 to subscribe to The Athletic. You get a great rate there. And I am telling you, with the trade deadline and all the stories we have going on around the trade deadline, even one as complicated and weird and maybe even quiet as this year has been, there are going to be deals. And right now, top of mind, as I sit here and think about it, and I was talking to an executive this morning about the New York Islanders. Anders Lee, news comes out that he is out for the season. This is a really good team. And this is a team that you can see, not that we're getting any information out of Lou Lamoriello and his front office, but I know the expectation around the league from others is that this is a team you could see being aggressive and being aggressive buyers. And I was talking to someone and he said, you know who would make a ton of sense there is Taylor Hall. Taylor Hall, of course, has a no trade, but Buffalo is a disaster. He went there on a 1-year deal, probably thinking he'd be part of the next, wave of success with the Sabres, maybe finally turning a corner for that organization. And it just hasn't happened. But the reality is, if you're the New York Islanders, you're looking for a pure goal scorer, some offense to replace what Anders Lee will be missing there. He is just about the perfect option. I mean, there's some interesting wingers. Kyle Palmieri comes to mind that, also might make sense. But boy, Taylor Hall with the Islanders, that's interesting. And if he's willing to waive his no trade, and Taylor has every right to do whatever he wants, he's bounced around and he's earned that opportunity. But if you're Taylor Hall and you can go play for Barry Trotz on a really good Islanders team that in a really weird year, anything can happen and has already shown they're capable of making a long run, that has to be appealing to you. And I just love that fit. I'm not one to sit here and like predict trades. I am, because it's a lot of fun and I love talking about that stuff. But in terms of fits, I love that. And it'll be fascinating to see as the trade deadline gets closer what the Islanders do in that regard. And really what Buffalo does with all those, there's a lot of work to be done there for Kevin Adams and his front office. All right, not to get completely sidetracked, but anyways, last thing, if you want to leave a review for this podcast, I would greatly appreciate it. Go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever it is you listen to podcasts. Leave a review. Make sure you're subscribing so you get all the latest episodes. And that is it. Thanks again to Ryan Hardy for joining this podcast. Thank you for listening and have a great week.